first case for argument this morning is Ali against Mukasey. Mr. Morley.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Morley. I represent Ibrahim Ali, a lawful permanent resident of the United States. Mr. Ali has been deprived of his opportunity to have a fact-based discretionary hearing before an immigration judge because the Board of Immigration Appeals has concluded that his crime of conspiracy to traffic in firearms constitutes a crime of moral turpitude. Now, in order to determine whether an offense constitutes a crime of moral turpitude, we look to the elements of the statute. And in this case, what we see is a statute that makes it a crime to import, deal, transport.
Why do we look to the elements of the statute?
Why?
Yeah, why?
Case law has told us that that is an essential element.
Forget case law. Why?
Because we engage in the categorical analysis so as to avoid the problem of going to a problem of having fact-based mini trials before immigration courts. This way, we can also determine.
The immigration system wants to do that. What skin is that off the judge's nose?
Well,
see, the reason I ask this is because it's not only because we have a conflict within the Seventh Circuit about whether we are stuck with the face of the papers, but the reason the Supreme Court gave for sticking with the face of the papers in recidivist prosecutions in federal courts is the Sixth Amendment. That is, we want to have a system so that judges don't trench on the jury's prerogative. But that's completely irrelevant in immigration law.
I agree that that's not the basis, but it is the one that the Board of Immigration Appeals has applied, has consistently applied, and most courts of appeals have followed that, perhaps because not on the Sixth Amendment.
I don't see how the Board could apply it consistently or not, because it's inconsistent with the immigration statute. Section 1229A3C3B4 says that the board can look at things like the pre-sentence report. It's right in statute.
They can look at, but not in terms of defining whether or not a matter becomes a conviction. And recently, the Board of Immigration Appeals has held that in order to make certain kinds of determinations to assess whether or not a particular offense, in that case it involved whether or not there was more than $10,000 at stake, they could look at those kinds of documents. But the Board of Immigration Appeals has held to the categorical analysis because it seeks to avoid the confusion of mini trials, lots of facts, having to bring in evidence, prosecutors, having to bring in live witnesses to establish whether or not this was a proper conviction under the Act.
I'm now lost. Looking at the pre-sentence report doesn't involve live witnesses.
No, it doesn't.
It is apparently, so far as I can tell from reading the statute, authorized by the statute, and is completely compatible with the rationale in federal cases like Shepard because there's no Sixth Amendment problem. So I'm completely at sea for why you think it can't be done.
It can't be done because the Board of Immigration Appeals consistently has held for over 50 years that it should not be done, that the categorical analysis is a mechanism by which
the reason why the board can't follow the statute is because it's disregarded the statute in the past.
No, the reason is the board looks to the pre-sentence report in certain discrete cases, but other than that, the board does not want to get involved in factual disputes beyond that.
I just don't see how you can say the board does not want X when in this very case the board looked at the pre-sentence report.
And erroneously, in conflict with their most recent decision, Babaysakov.
Incompatibility with the plain language of the statute.
Because they don't look at it, because the case law that the board has expressed has placed a veneer on that statute. In other words, they don't say we can look at it in every case. They still strive to adhere to the categorical analysis because they don't want mini trials throughout the immigration court system, because in this case, maybe they could get away with just looking at a pre-sentence report, but there might be other cases where additional evidence would have to be brought in, where witnesses might be brought in, where we might want to get into a fight. What does the pre-sentence report actually say? And therefore, we may have to bring live witnesses like the pre-sentence report writer into immigration court to determine what facts he found that underlie the conclusions in that pre-sentence report. Remember, the pre-sentence report are facts established by a preponderance of the evidence. The immigration court must find removability by clear and convincing evidence. So just because the board looks to a pre-sentence report does not establish a fact by the level of proof that is required under immigration law. The categorical analysis also, what the categorical analysis does as well is make certain there is some level of uniformity. That is that people who are convicted under a particular statute are the ones that abide, that suffer the consequences. We don't look in terms of, well, a person engaged in certain conduct under that statute, therefore they're subject to removal, but they perhaps engage in more benign conduct under that statute and therefore not subject to removal. We look to establishing a certain level of uniformity, and I believe the categorical analysis serves us well in that regard. It has not been abandoned in any respect, and in fact, both this court has continues to apply it, as well as the Board of Immigration Appeals, even in its most recent decisions, continues to apply the categorical analysis. In this case, what we have is a failure in the categorical analysis. There is nothing in the analysis of this statute, 922, that makes this a crime of moral turpitude. Even the most dangerous offenses require some level of mental intent, to establish moral turpitude. In this case, we have no such level of mental intent. What we have is really a purely regulatory statute. The Board of Immigration Appeals, in their decision, looked to 922 and said, in this case, we have merely what we have here is a statute that is so dangerous, we're going to make it moral turpitude. But in reaching that conclusion, they look to conduct, not to the statute. This same statute punishes both danger, it punishes both the kind of conduct in which my client engaged, which was surreptitious sales of firearms in a neighborhood, as well as the person who inherits a cache of firearms, sells them to his friends and neighbors because he knows they're avid hunters. It affects
it's
both of them equally.
Pre-sentence report in the administrative record.
The page that the Board of Immigration Appeals looked to. The Board of Immigration is in the administrative record.
The
entire pre-sentence.
There or just
no,
one page?
Just that one page that the Board of Immigration Appeals looked to. It's the only reference they made. That page is there.
Did you ask that the whole PSR be included?
No, because the rest of the PSR was not relevant.
Okay.
That was the only reference to it, and that's what the board looked to that clause, that phrase, in order to find there was inherent fraud in this case.
What does the charging document say in the judgment of conviction?
The charging document said
regarding the underlying crime,
conspiracy to violate 922A1, conspiracy to violate 924A, 1A, 924A1.
A1A.
No, it does not say A1A. That's the other problem in the BIA decision. The Board of Immigration Appeals concluded that Mr. Ali violated 924A1, capital letter A. There's not a shred of evidence, documentary, otherwise, that he did.
Isn't that what the indictment charged?
No, it did not. It charged 924A1, not 924A1A.
What did the plea agreement say?
924A1. Did not specify. There are four subsections, cap A, B, and C, D.
But all of the offenses under 924A1 are willful offenses. And A1A requires a false statement.
A requires a false statement. D says that any offense committed willfully under the statute.
So why doesn't that satisfy the mental state required for a crime of moral turpitude?
There are two reasons why it doesn't. Number one, that's not the basis of the BIA decision. And the Chenery Doctrine tells us that if the BIA or an agency makes a decision We are stuck with the basis of that decision. The BIA said it was 924A1A. They did not look to D. They looked to A. That's the basis of their decision. It is not up for up to federal courts to reinterpret what it is the BIA really meant. The other reason is that even if it's done willfully, that by itself does not establish moral turpitude. If we look at LVC, that's an offense that involves intentional structuring of money, of money laundering, with an intent to not to, you know, with an intent not to place, to avoid detection, and in that, intentionally not following the law, and in that sense, it has a more specific intent than doing something willfully, and yet in that case, the government found that, the board found that it was not moral turpitude. So merely making something willful does not establish moral turpitude.
Mr. Juncker.
Good morning. May it please the court, John Yunchai on behalf of the United States Attorney General. Your Honors, this court should defer to the BIA's reasonable and correct conclusion that Mr. Ali was convicted of a crime involving moral turpitude. And the limited issue before this panel, of course, is that question, whether or not Mr. Ali or that this...
How do we know that he violated 924A1A, the fraud subsection?
Well, Your Honor, there was much discussion about the categorical approach and...
Skip the categorical approach. How do we know that he violated the fraud subsection?
We know from the conviction record. Mr. Co-counsel, opposing counsel, I should say, excuse me, talked about the conviction record and what was in there. The indictment specifically references misrepresentation, concealment, and hiding in order to fulfill the conspiracy to commit a crime under 922A and 924. So the question that's left is which subsection, because the charging documents as well as the judgment don't specify which subsection he was convicted of, the question is left to the conviction record to ascertain which part of that Mr. Ali was convicted of. So you look to the indictment. The indictment contains language in count one, which he pled guilty to, of the concealment. Of course, 924A1A talks about knowingly making any false statement or representation. So you have a statement in the indictment charging misrepresentation and concealment, which is consistent with 924A1A. A1A also in 924 deals with keeping records that a person who should be licensed should be keeping. And part of the indictment also...
Failure to keep records is not fraud. So in your answer to the question, how do we know he committed fraud, is that you think that's the allegation of the indictment?
Your Honor, the answer is that we look to the criminal record to see what in the criminal record would pin the specific A1A subsection to matters that are referenced in the record. One of them being the concealment misrepresentation in the charging document. The only part of 924A1 where you have that language is in 924A1A. So that's where the tie-in is with the conviction record. I bring up the keeping of records because the indictment also charges Mr. Ali with not keeping the appropriate ATF forms, which the government utilizes to track where these weapons are going.
What was the factual basis for the plea?
The factual basis for the plea, Your Honor? Mm-hmm. Well, it tracked the indictment. So beyond the indictment, the factual basis...
We have the Rule 11 colloquy in the administrative record?
I believe we do, Your Honor.
What did the judge use to validate the plea?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What did the judge use to factually validate the plea before accepting it, and what did the defendant admit to?
The defendant admitted to... Well, this, if I can point the court directly to the plea agreement, which is in the record at 708.
As I recall, the plea agreement referred to the counts that he would be pleading guilty to and referred back to the indictment, but typically there would be a record made at the time of the plea about the factual basis?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And do we have that in the administrative record?
We do, Your Honor. At page 708. I mean, the factual basis starts at page...
And you're referring to the transcript, then, not the indictment?
I'm referring to the plea agreement.
The plea agreement, not the transcript. So we don't have the transcript of the underlying plea. That's
what's being... My question was, is the Rule 11 colloquy in the record? And you said yes.
I misunderstood, Your Honor. Okay. I was going to the plea agreement. The answer is no.
We don't.
Right.
So we don't know what was used to factually validate the plea.
Well, Your Honor, I believe in the judgment. However, the...
It just refers back to the indictment.
Right.
So we don't know.
So what, but I mean, to go back to the question of how we know it's 924A1A, I mean, the criminal record, the indictment is something that can be relied upon to determine what part of that 924A1 Mr. Ali was found to conspire to seek to commit a crime under. And that's in the indictment. So to answer your question, how do we know?
Not all so simple. If the indictment charges two ways to commit a crime, plea could be based on either one of them. One reason why it would be helpful to have the Rule 11 statement of the factual basis.
I understand, Your Honor. But beyond 924A1, the question here is also whether categorically under 922A1A, that in itself is a crime involving moral turpitude. I mean, forget fraud. Without the fraud, what the conviction here involves is clearly a crime involving moral turpitude under the standard that this court followed in the Padilla decision, referencing back to the Maya decision. And that is, first of all, it referenced the BIA decisions that talk about a crime being inherently moral, depraved, contrary to the accepted rules of morality. Then it cites to the Maya decision, wherein it states that a crime involving moral turpitude is one that is deliberately committed and serious, either in the terms of the magnitude of the loss that it causes or the indignation that it arouses in the law-abiding public. Now, we just heard that the attempt to crunch two different categories of persons under this conviction, 922A1A, the person, the hunter, who is selling or using firearms with his family, and the sale of firearms for the purpose, for more nefarious purposes. The decision that the government cites to, the Bryan versus United States decision, puts that to rest clearly. In 1986, this very statute that Mr. Ali was convicted of was amended so that the statute would be clear that it only, and this was language utilized by Congress, and it's in the Bryan decision at 189. The 86 Act was amended so it would be clear that it did not cover law-abiding citizens, such as individuals who were using guns for the purpose of hunting or for the keeping of an individual's right to bear arms for their own protection. The Act was amended so that it would specify that these persons that are convicted of 922A1A are persons who are engaging in unlawful activity, which they know to be unlawful, which was the conclusion in that decision. And it also acknowledged, and this is very important because it attracts the board's reasoning in relying on the categorical analysis that this is a crime involving moral turpitude, it talks about the public risk inherent in the unlicensed trafficking of firearms. The Supreme Court talks about it, and it references Congress's expressed language to that effect, and that's what the board talked about here.
The usual understanding of things like crime of moral turpitude is that it's an effort to distinguish malum prohibitum from malum in se, and licensing offenses are the core of malum prohibitum. There was no need to license firearms in the United States until quite recently. And maybe after this term of the Supreme Court, there won't be again. The idea that violating a licensing statute is a crime of moral turpitude is, well, very difficult to square with legal history.
Well, Your Honor, I think the Bryan decision speaks directly to that. What the Supreme Court said in Bryan was the 1986 amendments were meant to alleviate two vague areas, whether this was a strict liability, malum prohibitum offense, thereby covering the hunters, if you will, and also to specify that this, and this is at page 189 of that decision, and also to clarify that this involves people that engage in the business of selling firearms. And they put that language in there to to clarify what...
So what? Barbers have to be licensed in Illinois, but cutting somebody's hair without a license as part of a business is not a crime of moral turpitude. I just don't see any opening for saying that somebody who engages in a business without a license has committed a crime of moral turpitude.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, cutting someone's hair and selling firearms that are untracked into the public are two totally different things which can be distinguished. And frankly, it arouses the indignation of the public. I mean, I think those two things can't be...
Arouses the indignation of the public? Do you realize that more than half of all the members of Congress have just filed a brief in the Supreme Court saying that the Second Amendment prohibits the licensing schemes that they have themselves enacted?
Well, Your Honor, it could be, as Judge Posner talked about in the Mai decision, sometimes these decisions are razor thin as to what's a crime involving moral turpitude or not. But I must say that, for example, I mean, to be very clear, I see my time is running out. There's an analogy made between the trafficking of drugs, which is a crime involving moral turpitude, because there's an inherent risk in that, and clearly that there is a risk in trafficking drugs. I think it's fair to say that trafficking in firearms, very similarly, is a crime involving moral turpitude.
But one can be legal and one not.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Trafficking in firearms is legal under certain circumstances.
Correct.
Trafficking in drugs is never.
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. That is the distinction there. But beyond that, the unlicensed sale of firearms where the government cannot track where these firearms are going, such as to individuals who intend to use them for crimes, drugs, murder, what have you, is very, very close to a public risk, which Congress talked about in the Bryan decision. I urge the court to read that and look closely at it. And that is the basis and supports the board's decision in this case.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank
the case is taken under advisement.